Woohoo Hype, not your ordinary wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey sort of podcast.
Welcome, everybody, back to our latest episode of Who Hype. We're still waiting our next episodes of Doctor Who, but we figured there's a lot to talk about until we do get our next episodes coming up. So today on the podcast, this is Laura, and I'm being joined by Natalie and Jen. And just a really quick reminder, if you want to know how to get in touch with us, you can email us at whohype@hypeable.com. You can send us a tweet at whohype, or you can send a comment on any one of the Doctor Who news stories that we have on hypeable.com. So I thought we'd maybe kick this off today by talking about some of the news stories that are coming up. One of them I thought was actually kind of funny because we sort of quasi had something to do with it. The BBC announced that they were going to have a series of what they were calling 11E shorts, which I basically guess translates as to electronic short story. I don't know why they needed the term, but anyway, it made them happy. They have a well-known, to use their terms, a well-known children's author is going to write each one of these stories, and obviously Doctor Who being such a British franchise, you know, one would assume these people have very strong ties to the United Kingdom. So when I heard about it, I decided to fantasize, well, who would some of these authors be? So, you know, right away there are some names that, like, leap immediately to mind. You know, you start thinking Philip Pullman in The Golden Compass. You know, you start thinking all sorts of names. And, you know, who is the most famous British children's author of the 20th century? Who is still alive? Okay, you know, A.A. Milne is out of the picture. You know, Roald Dahl died about 20 years ago. So who is it? It's J.K. Rowling. So I write this story on Hypeable covering the fact that, you know, they're going to be doing these with what they described as famous authors. I surmise likely, given that it's Doctor Who, that they're going to be British. So I mention, I don't know, like half a dozen names that I'm just going to come clean. Here's where I got the half a dozen names from, folks. I went to Wikipedia and checked out who had won in the UK what is the equivalency of the Newbery Award for children's literature. Only in the UK it's the Guardian Award. Figured out who was still alive and who wrote fantasy, and that's who I picked. And then on top of that, I put people like Pullman and Anthony Horowitz, who I know writes the Alex Rider series, and figured, just throw it out there. Well, imagine my surprise when everybody started sourcing us as having this inside track to think that J.K. Rowling was going to be writing a story. And that was like the rumor that went around the internet. But I am just here to say that, no, I have no inside information. I merely have Wikipedia. So I don't know that that'll get out on a news story, but just coming clean on where that rumor went. So despite the rumor mill, how are we feeling about, you know, I don't even know if I'm going to say his name right. Is it Ian Coughler? Is that how we say his name correctly? Jen, you would probably know better than me.
It's Ian Coughler.
Okay, because I'm not even saying the man's name right. There we go.
No, you have it spelled wrong. That's why.
Oh, that's just sad. See, this goes to show how I use Wikipedia, folks. Here's further proof. I have no inside knowledge. I have Wikipedia, and I read too quickly. So, I mean, I know my son has read a lot of his books, you know, and people like him. How do you guys feel about him, you know, being one of our authors chosen for this and for the first one?
He writes extremely cool kind of almost fantasy sci-fi novels, and they're a huge hit. I mean, they do really well. When a book releases, it almost always hits the New York Times bestselling list. I mean, the Artemis Fowl series is really big in the States. I'm assuming it's pretty big in England as well, but it's huge here. And so I'm pretty excited about it because he's a strong writer. He knows his audience, and he's a huge Doctor Who fan. Just listening to his interview and reading some of the comments that he made, he's very much into making sure that this is perfect, which is fantastic. And he's writing about the first Doctor, which is really interesting as well. I think he's going to do a fantastic job with it. Just because of his background and what he writes now, I think it fits Doctor Who really well.
Natalie, how about you? Have you any experience with the Artemis Fowl books? I mean, me, I can say that I've seen them on my son's shelves, but I can't say that I've ever picked up one of them.
Yeah, I'm going to say something really stupid here that everyone's going to laugh at, but when this was announced, I was really shocked that Ian Coughler had picked the first Doctor, because somewhere in my delusional mind, I thought that he was one of the young writers, like one of those kids who wrote their first book at like 15, and then Artemis. I think I was actually mixing him up with Artemis, like with the character of Artemis in the book, and I don't know how. I have read a couple of the books, but and Artemis is this very kind of sassy, kind of genius male protagonist, and for some bizarre reason, I had it in my head that Eowyn Colfer was like a young writer, and I was like, why is he writing the first Doctor if he won't even, like, he's like my age or something, isn't he? Like, he's too young to, like, you know that, and he doesn't have access to all the tapes. It all makes a lot more sense now that I've realised that I've totally mixed that up, and he is not, in fact, one of those child writers. But I haven't read all of Artemis Fowl, but I do like it. I think it's really cool, and he has some pretty unique ideas, so it could be very interesting.
I thought what was so interesting, what fascinated me at first when he was announced, because, you know, the first thing, again, I do, because, like, Google and Wikipedia are my friends, I went out to check out why was he picking the first Doctor. And like, to me, most people usually pick the Doctor that they knew as kids. And when you do his birth date, he's born in 1965, which, unless he is the most precocious 2-year-old in the world and had ESP, had no knowledge of William Hartnell's Doctor, you know, from a TV perspective. And then come to discover, apparently, he didn't actually see an episode of Doctor Who until, like, the late 70s, where he was in rural Ireland. He didn't really have access to the programming growing up. It was a cousin of his that brought over to his house, like, the Doctor Who comics and the serials and the novels, all of which are still popular today, but were very popular in the 70s. And that was his first experience with Doctor Who, was from a written standpoint. And I thought, well, that's fascinating to have somebody write the story who didn't jump on because it was a visual media to him. It was a written media. I thought that was really amazing. I also think it's really cool that I think a lot of fans, you know, there's always certain characters that fans always say, you know, of Classic Who, they want back all the time, you know, and right away, you know, one of the names that pops up all the time is Tegan. Of course, we always hear Sarah Jane. Adric is a perennial favorite. The Brig is a perennial favorite. But one of the people we hear about people wanting back all the time is Susan, who is the Doctor's granddaughter, who appeared with him in the very first serials. And apparently the story that's being written is about the first Doctor and his granddaughter Susan before they ever get to Earth and meet the next series of companions that join up with them, which are a bunch of English school teachers. But I thought that was, like, really cool that, at least also in his story, I think he's going to be satisfying the wishes of a lot of fans who really wanted to see a reappearance of Susan. And I think that's
I think it's such a unique take on the Doctor from what people who are watching the show now are used to think that the Doctor has actual family that traveled with him. It's a whole different kind of aspect that we can't get right now because it's not an option knowing what's happened. So I think that's a really great thing to see as well, to see the Doctor with family and what family did for him compared to now when he's all alone.
Yeah, I mean, because it's only since the reboot that he's had this tragic, like, last of the Time Lords, he doesn't have a planet, etc. thing going on. Very interesting as well, potentially, to get deciding to kill off his family or whatever, because, you know, we've got a few little references, you know, when they say, you know, oh, were you a father? And he's like, not anymore or whatever. And, like, we know that he basically, you know, blew up Gallifrey or whatever, but not, you know, the smaller specifics about his actual personal life. So, yeah, it would be, you know, in that crossover period between 8 and 9, that had to happen at some point as well. So that could be interesting or traumatic or something.
Do you guys have any favorite authors you want? I mean, obviously, I think it would be amazing if J.K. Rowling popped in on one of these e-shorts. Do you guys have anybody in particular that you are keen to see write one of these e-shorts that's coming up?
Catherine Fisher, who wrote the Incarceron series, is a really talented writer. She's amazing, and I think she would be fantastic.
The one that I actually am kind of keen on is Anthony Horowitz, who wrote the Alex Rider series. I'm actually a fan of his because of another series that he writes on BBC, but it was an old ITV series called Foyles War, and I was a huge Foyles War fan. And so I'm really keen to see him write one of them because I think he has a really good sense of drama and what makes, you know, a compelling story. So he's definitely one of my favorites. And like I said, most people know him from the Alex Rider series. I'm more familiar with him from Foyle's War, but I would really like to see him make an appearance.
I can't think of anyone. Do we know it's going to be people who are, you know, have written big series, or is it just, you know...
Their only hint was that they said famous children's authors. Now, I made the presumption that it would be someone with strong ties to the UK. I mean, I suppose they could, you know, have a US citizen, but it just strikes me that Moffat does seem to have a good deal of contempt, and I would say rightly so, for US media and yes. US money and people who are heavily influenced by US culture. I mean, I even think when they on the Harry, I can't remember if this was on the Harry Potter DVDs or if this was part of the Harry Potter tour when I went to go see it, mm-hmm. but one of the early on producers said that he felt very, very strongly that they had to have, you know, British cast and a lot of British mm-hmm. influences, because otherwise they'd end up with cheerleaders at Hogwarts. You know, you'd end up with something very anachronistic, and I feel like Doctor Who is the same kind of thing. It would be really anachronistic otherwise.
I would like to see what Philip Pullman did with it. I have no idea whether he's a fan or not, like whether it would be something he'd consider, because he sort of hates everything. He doesn't like a lot of things. But another one I'd be interested to see, and I don't know whether this would work out because he's not exactly a fantasy writer, is Michael Morpurgo. Like, he could do something, you know, potentially a historical kind of episode with one of the Doctors. He, you know, if you don't know who that is, he writes a lot of children's books. He wrote the novel of War Horse, which is obviously the stage show and the musical, but he's written 30 or 40 children's books, and they're usually about, nearly all of them are in some way like a war era like book, and a lot of them are to do with animals as well, but some of them are just about people, like young people in wartime. And so I wouldn't mind seeing him do like a historical episode with one of the Doctors.
Speaking of stories and different stories, Mark Gatiss is busy away doing the Doctor Who 50th anniversary. I guess I really shouldn't call it the 50th anniversary special in of itself, because it's clearly only one aspect of what they have going on. But Mark Gatiss is going to be penning this sort of historical docudrama on the making of Doctor Who and, you know, how it got started, how it got launched on the BBC. So anyway, Mark Gatiss is penning this, you know, this retrospective, this costume docudrama of the roots of how Doctor Who got started and the whole story behind the story. And today they just announced that, they didn't announce. He announced on his own Twitter. A guy by the name of Matt Strevens or Strevens. I'm not really sure how he pronounces his name. But he was one of the creative talents and the directors on BBC's Misfits, which I confess is not really a show that I watch, though I do watch a lot of British TV. And now he's jumping on board along with this project. Do you guys have any experience with Misfits at all? I know I've never really watched it. So what do you think about it, Natalie?
It's pretty dark. Like it's an interesting show. I mean, it's a post-Watershed show. It's rude. It's like they drop language that I don't know would ever get on television in America. But it's very standard for that, you know, very post-Watershed British kind of crowd. And I'm not talking Torchwood post-Watershed. I'm talking like See You Next Tuesday post-Watershed kind of words. But it's kind of really weird in that it's really just like very absurd plot lines in a very understated situation. Some of the stuff is really twisted. So I don't know what he's going to contribute to Doctor Who, except for that it might be somewhat dark, I guess. But we'll have to wait and see.
Doctor Who, like you've never seen Doctor Who before.
Yeah.
It was funny today, too, because I went looking for a picture of the guy, and usually, you know, you pop somebody's name in, you do a picture search on Google, and you get like a million pictures of it. Well, I found tons of pictures of the cast of Misfits. I had so many problems trying to find a picture of this guy. I'm like, he must be the most elusive guy ever on British TV.
I mean, I'm sure Misfits isn't the only thing he can do, you know, like I'm sure that, but it does... You know, it does ask the question about whether this is going to be a, if this is a biopic, you know, if it's going to be family friendly, like I'm going to really presume it is, or if it's going to be, if there's stuff that went on that was not particularly family friendly, whether it's going to be actually aimed at a slightly bigger audience than, you know, a slightly higher audience than Doctor Who itself.
Yeah, you know, that is a really good point, because I mean I have to think that, you know, because particularly in the UK, Doctor Who is very much aimed, you know, as the show that the family sits around at tea time and watches, and they have all the Doctor Who toys that are clearly aimed at, like, you know, the 8 and up crowd, probably even the 7s too, you know. So yeah, I mean, I would assume that this would be written on a more adult level, because part of it has to deal with the politics of just launching a show in 1963, and I mean, the guy who ended up directing it, I mean, he got it, frankly, as I understand it, because nobody else wanted it, and he was a really young guy, so they gave it to this, like, newbie that figured, oh, if he wrecks it up, it's not a big deal, it's not, you know, and who knew what it was going to turn into. So that is a really good question, if they aim it at a higher audience. The other thing that I think is interesting, too, you know, because we are coming up on the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who this year, from an American perspective, what it is also 50 years coming up on is the 50th anniversary of Who Shot John F. Kennedy. I mean, these two events happened, like, days apart. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know that, you know, Who Shot Kennedy was on the, you know, I'm sure it was news in the UK. How could it not be news? But I'm sure it wasn't news to the same extent that it was in America. I'm wondering if that will historical item will figure in any into the programming or the story of, you know, nobody noticed that we launched a new program because they were all busy watching, you know, news of the assassination. I wonder if any of that figures into the story in any capacity.
I would hope that it is a, you know, pretty, well, not hard hitting, but a, you know, a pretty serious biopic in that sense. And, you know, that they, you know, yeah, don't necessarily hold back in the sense of, I mean, I doubt it's going to be for children, you know. I doubt it's going to be Misfits-style post-Watershed, but I doubt it's going to be for children. There's no casting yet, is there?
No, there's not.
Who would you think of casting now as William Hartnell?
Oh, gosh. That's, well, you know who actually kind of even could look like him a little bit, but they'd never use him. Or maybe they would. Bernard Cribbins, who played... I mean, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
Like, to have Wilf?
I reckon they could do it. Like, I reckon they could. How old was he when he started the show?
Hartnell, I believe, was in his late 60s when he did the show initially. That's what I could be wrong. I'd have to Google that really quickly, but I'm pretty sure Hartnell was in his late 60s, but it was also an older-looking... you know, like, back then, people in their 50s and 60s, I just felt like looked a lot older. You know,
yeah.
It's just the way it was. So, I mean, Cribbins is in his late 70s, but he still seems to be a pretty active guy. I would love to see if he could do it. I just think he's an amazing actor. I'd love for him to be back. He would be awesome.
Yeah. The other person I was going to say, just looking at sort of, they'd have to age him up as opposed to aging Bernard Cribbins down. I don't know why, but I'm just looking at this picture and I'm just thinking it is Bill Bailey. I feel like that he could potentially do it as well. Like, there's something about his face and the way that he holds his body that I think he could potentially do it, but we'll have to wait and see, I guess. I'm sure it'll be someone quite... I'm sure that the casting for all of these BBC miniseries and biopics are always really awesome, so hopefully it'll be good.
Right, or as you say, Natalie, they're just going to pull somebody out of the BBC cupboard.
Yeah, it will be cupboardy. The whole thing will be cupboardy for sure, like, absolutely.
I love that, the BBC acting cupboard. Just pop somebody on out. I know, exactly, right? It could be very cool. All right, so moving on to the next item that, you know, something that we definitely noticed on the podcast and we definitely expressed our feelings on, and now Moffat himself has addressed, is why the TARDIS was redesigned. And Moffat has said that the reason that the TARDIS was redesigned is that it was a machine, it's a place, and he reiterated it even in an interview recently. So he hasn't just said it once, he said it twice, that, you know, it didn't have to have all these different, you know, he didn't want it to not look like a machine. And I don't know how I feel about that. How do you guys feel about Moffat's explanation that the TARDIS had to look more machine-like. I mean, it certainly is retro, but I don't know about that. What do you guys feel?
Well, what's the purpose of making it look more machine-like? I understand that he's saying it is a machine, but at the same time, it's also kind of the Doctor's remaining home and where he travels and lives, because it has areas that are reminiscent of a home. So while it may function as a machine, why does it need to look like a machine? And I feel like it's kind of all of a sudden he's decided it needs to look like a machine, because it hasn't for almost the entire reboot. It has looked fairly whimsical. It has had little oddities about it. And now it looks kind of cold and stark compared to everything that we've seen since the beginning of the reboot. So I feel like it's a why now kind of question more than a, is it a right or wrong thing? Like, why now? Why is he deciding now that this is what it needs to be?
Yeah, I have to say I entirely agree with that, too. I'm like, yeah, like, I really am still, I thought I would get better with it. I'm still having a hard time with the redecoration here of this.
Yeah, I've got some kind of, this is a totally made up theory that I'm just making up right now. But, well, first of all, I understand why it needed to change full stop, because I believe that it was meant to have been quite damaged. Like, they go up to it in the Amy and Rory's finale and they're like, what's wrong with it? Like, it had that like mold growing on the outside or something. There's something wrong with it. So I get that the TARDIS has done its reboot. Like, but with the maybe he doesn't want it to look like a home. Maybe he doesn't want it, like, I mean, like the Doctor, like, maybe he doesn't feel like that. Like, maybe it's part of his whole however many years of solitude he's been hanging around in the Victorian times for. And that he doesn't, number one, that he doesn't want it to be reminded of, he doesn't want to be reminded of Amy and Rory, and he wants it to be as different as possible. Or that he doesn't want to be, you know, doesn't want to take things frivolously or something anymore, and maybe it'll change again or warm up a bit. Like, maybe its colours will, you know, automatically warm up a bit or something. You know, the soul of the TARDIS will sort of pump a little bit more life into it once he kind of comes back into himself a bit more. I don't know. That's just my theory.
But the thing is, why wouldn't Moffat say something to that effect? Why would he just say it was too whimsical? It needed to be more like a machine? Like, it just seems like his answer was kind of a cop-out in a lot of ways. Like, it didn't make any sense, and it was just kind of like, that's it. That's why. But that's not really a reason. Do you know what I mean?
Like,
what's the purpose of it? And I thought the TARDIS, when it regenerated, that the TARDIS decided what it looked like, not the Doctor. Because the TARDIS regenerates when the Doctor regenerates.
Not always. Not always.
The TARDIS regenerates when it's damaged badly enough to need to. It happened to be a coincidence last time that both the TARDIS and the Doctor regenerated, but it doesn't always regenerate when he regenerates. And I think it does pick, but it also knows him, so it might have, like, you know, tonally picked up on something. I don't know. I honestly don't know. Maybe they just really wanted it to look different, and Moffat's trying to make excuses, which would be annoying. But
Which may dovetail into some of our discussion later, absolutely, completely. The other thing that I think is very interesting is going to the Christmas special, we had a blast from the past with an old foe of the Doctor's, the Great Intelligence, and, you know, everybody went scrambling to learn what could we learn about the Great Intelligence. Well, the fact of the matter is this. You can't get the episodes of the Great Intelligence. Part of these episodes, if not all of them, were, I mean, not quite all of them, but most significant parts of the episodes concerning the Great Intelligence were obliterated by the BBC in this mass clean-out that they did. I don't remember if it was the late 60s or early 70s. Of just things that they just didn't think they needed, they didn't have the foresight, and they dumped things. Now, what I think is hilarious is it's not just Doctor Who that got decimated by this great throwing out of things. Do you want to know what else they threw out? They threw out the only live performance of the Beatles on the BBC. I mean, clearly someone was asleep at the switch. I can hear you beating something to death.
I'm slow clapping the BBC. Good job, guys. Good job. I know that they lost the tape. I know that they also got rid of, I think, the tapes of Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie's first sketch show that was done on as well. And I don't know when that was exactly, but the same thing happened to their first sketch show that they did. When they were first commissioned for TV.
Yeah, I mean, it's just unfathomable, like the amount of things that they pitched out. And now, here's what's kind of hilarious. What does survive photography of it, like visual stills that people took either like while the production was going on. Some of them were PR stills. Some of them were just captures of images. But what did happen, and it took me a while to remember that people used to do this. People used to take, I mean, and this is just like how low-tech it was, folks. They would take their little cassette recorders, or in those days, even their reel-to-reel tape machines, and would record things that were on the TV, and then they would play it back later, because they had not yet really fully invented the concept of the rerun. So the audio files from all of these episodes have been preserved, either from fans who had recorded it, or sometimes, you know, an affiliate station somewhere, you know, like the BBC affiliates in Australia or Canada had recorded a copy and they weren't supposed to. So there are bits and pieces of the audio files that do exist. So what has happened sometimes is enterprising fans on YouTube have taken the full audio file and then taken still pictures from it and tried to piece together what's the episode, which I have to say, it kind of reminds me almost like those little flip cards when I was younger, and you would watch the little movie as you would, like, you know, flip on the cards and people would make their little motions. Like, it's not the best way to watch it. I mean, personally, I think you'd be better off just, like, not looking and just listening to it. But in any case, in response to this, the BBC is actually put up a section on the Great Intelligence on their website, and they keep filling it in with more and more data. So clearly they want people to be up to speed on this thing when Doctor Who reboots, or I shouldn't say reboots, when Doctor Who comes back in April. They clearly want us to know a lot about the Great Intelligence and are taking great pains to put that information out there. So I do have to give the BBC props on this one for putting that info out there, because otherwise you are on this ridiculous goose chase all over, you know, YouTube and Daily Motion and Vimeo, just trying to figure out where chunks of these pieces are as to what the Great Intelligence is. But pretty much the most important elements when it comes down to it, it is an enemy that the Doctor faced more than once. The Great Intelligence, at one point, it was trying to inhabit the bodies of the Yetis, or the Abominable Snowmen, which I think is, like, hilarious. I mean, it's a great foe. And then at another point, they were in the London Underground, and I think that's probably part of where Vostra comes into this, is because they were at one point involved in the London Underground, and that they weren't truly defeated. They just kind of went away, and the Doctor knew that he would face them again one day. So if you guys want to, you know, catch up on Great Intelligence, definitely check out the BBC UK site. And they do have a whole collection on the Great Intelligence, which I'm hoping it's going to be enough when we come back to the episodes in April. And, you know, we can understand what's going on. I hope that Moffat isn't going to be relying too heavily on people having read it, because I don't know that everybody, you know, visits those, you know, backlog sections on the BBC UK site. I mean, you really have to be dedicated to want to skim through some of this stuff.
These episodes that were deleted, it wasn't every single episode, was it? Because I've seen clips from, right. I'm sure I've seen bits of older episodes. And, I mean, do you know what date they sort of stopped deleting at? Like,
yeah,
if there are any episodes that
By the time they got up to the Fourth Doctor is where they had definitely stopped that process altogether. They realized their folly. Yeah. And actually, the reason that a lot of this stuff exists for the first three Doctors is literally dumb luck, or people finding canisters of film, like, in people's attics. Or even, like we said, like, you know, they would send, you know, because nothing was digital back then, they would send an actual canister. You know, they would send it to Australia, to the BBC, you know, affiliates in Australia. And if somebody there hadn't thrown somebody out, oh, look, we rescued a section from here. Or they would rescue it. I mean, literally throughout the British Empire, they have rescued over the past 50 years various canisters of film. And, like, every so often, somebody else turns up another canister that's, you know, been sitting in granddad's attic, and he used to work at the BBC, and look what he took home one day that he wasn't supposed to. You know, it's literally kind of stuff that is the only reason we have a lot of these things. It's really amazing. I mean, the you know, the old Hollywood lore and legend goes that Desi Arnaz, when it was time to film I Love Lucy, demanded that it be shot on film, like high-quality film, rather than, you know, kind of the cheapy stuff that they were filming TV shows on. And everybody said, oh, you're crazy, you're crazy, you're crazy. And he goes, nope, we need to do this. And, you know, incredibly smart man, because you look at episodes now of I Love Lucy and they're crisp and you can see what's going on. And a lot of other shows that were shot in the 60s, I mean, you know, it's just that, deteriorated
studio,
over
the
time.
The Desilu Studios pretty much invented the rerun.
They did. They did. Yeah. I mean, Desi Arnaz, smart, smart guy to know the value of that when everybody else thought, no, what are you gonna need this for? You know, very smart guy.
Well, I think it's really interesting that they're giving us so much information and making it like a big glaring sign. Like, I think that's really interesting because that's not something they typically do. So I'm kind of curious to see where that all leads to and why they want us to know so much about it and be so familiar with it.
Yeah, it's going to, I mean, I just don't know where this is leading. I don't know. I definitely am looking forward to something with the London Underground because I feel like we haven't had that yet. You know, it's such an iconic
British thing. Underground's anniversary as well. They're having their anniversary this year of either 150 years, I think, or 100 years of the existence of the Underground. So let's do that.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's like really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, what's, you know, one of those iconic moments of British life is the Underground and Mind the Gap and all that, you know. So the fact that the Great Intelligence did have, you know, connections to the Underground, I think it would be really cool to seg all that back in again, you know, because I mean, how many times have, you know, we've landed on Big Ben once, the spaceship is knocked over Big Ben another time. You know, we've had the aliens at the London Eye. You know, they've been in a couple of really iconic locations. We did Stonehenge too, right? Yeah, we did Stonehenge. So I think we really should have, you know, something, you know, with the London Underground, just again, to get that iconic British moment. And I think that would be really cool.
And he did have the lunchbox with the Underground map on it. So
yes.
Yeah, so a little foreshadowing there or something. That could be really awesome. I just think we should totally, totally see that. That would be very, very cool. The other thing that we just wanted to point out, and I didn't really run with the story on Hypable, but it's kind of made the rounds a little bit, and it's gone up and it's gone down. But just to clarify, there was a rumor that went around sort of on and off over the last 2 weeks, and I've kind of been tracking it to see if it would take legs. And today it was finally debunked. There was a rumor initiated that said that it had been confirmed that all the 11 doctors would be making an appearance in the whatever is the specific Doctor Who story. That will be the 50th anniversary story itself, not the Mark Gatiss thing, but what will be a true, you know, Whovian story with the Doctor. And it had initially, you know, people were saying, oh yeah, it's confirmed. Well, the fact of the matter is it's not confirmed. Everybody who is running the story has since taken it down and basically said, yeah, no, they got suckered by something and it's, you know, it hasn't come to pass. I mean, so as of now, the only ways that we are getting appearances by all 11 doctors is it's coming up in that Nick Briggs audio story that he's creating. And then it's also coming up with these e-shorts, but that's the only way we know so far that all 11 incarnations of the Doctor are popping back in. But I certainly would like to see them in some manage, if it's archival footage, if it's photographs, just something. I really would like to see them take part in this, whatever's going to be the 50th episode.
My quick question about the e-shorts that I may have missed, are they going to be animated? Like, how are they doing this exactly?
They're just electronic. Yeah, they are going to publish.
Oh.
Yeah.
So it is a book. It is an online book.
Yeah, I think they're being cutesy and calling it an e-short instead of a novella. I don't really know why they feel the need to coin a new term.
Okay, that was confusing me. Yeah. All right, that makes more sense.
And then,
illustrated?
You know, we don't know the answer to that. That's a very good question. They haven't said that one way or the other, so that's an excellent question. I know that once all 11 are out, and that would presumably put us at November, Penguin is going to then produce a hard copy of them. So once every single one is out, if you want an actual book version of it, you could get an actual book version of it. It would be cool, though, if they illustrated it. That would be fun. I'm going to say probably not, only because I feel like they would have mentioned that in the PR too. One of the things that I thought might be interesting to discuss here, and because we are in our off season ish, is Stephen Moffat himself. You know, I had just gotten Doctor Who magazine. It finally has worked its way over the Atlantic and gotten to me like 2 weeks after everybody else gets it. In there, he had a Q&A in the magazine, and there, a lot of it was rehash. It wasn't really any incredibly new material. But one of the things that he was talking about was that he's definitely not going to resurrect his Twitter because he felt it was a distraction for him for writing, and it was just too much feedback, and he was getting too much information all the time, and he just wanted, he couldn't concentrate on his writing. So I thought that was an interesting thought there. And maybe it's kind of interesting to talk about Moffat's writing. What would you guys say when it comes to Moffat? I mean, we've had him as the showrunner and as the writer. What do you think is Moffat's greatest strength when it comes to Doctor Who and Whovian stories? And
that's a tricky one.
It's just like a job interview where you sit down and you're like, what are your greatest strengths? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm bad at saying things
like that.
Or
maybe like compared to like Russell T. Davies. Like what do you think his, what do you think Moffat, like the biggest thing that Moffat brings to the table is?
I think Moffat's done a really excellent job of casting and bringing people together that have really good chemistry and that can build characters that we love and that we're sad when they go and that we really enjoy watching every week. I think that's a huge strength of his, bringing in like characters that are just you connect with.
Even if they're only one-offs.
Yeah, even some of the one-offs, let's face it. Even like Wilford, who was only on like, what was he, 3 episodes maybe? But he had the big one at the end of Tenet's season. He was fantastic, and you loved him, and you wanted to see more of him. The same with Rory's dad. I mean, these are great character actors, but they're bringing something in that's really special. So finding those people, casting those people, and making sure they have the material to work with, I think is a really big strength of his.
Yeah, I think of Moffat, and I think of one of the strengths of his that I really like is that if he is in a one-off situation, I think he tells a really good, tight, one-off story. I don't know all the time if the arc over things works, but I feel like if you're looking for a really tight, compact story, he's really, really good at that. You know, if for no other reasons, the evidence of when people look at, the stories before Moffat took over, if you said, what was your favorite, story
episodes,
the 2005 series or the 2006, almost invariably, it was the Stephen Moffat story. And I think he also does, I think he's also really, I guess, at his best when he does something kind of historical. You know, like the Captain Jack story that he started was set into the backdrop of World War II initially. We had the Madame de Pompadour story. That's like a historical story. I think he's at his best when he does something historically linked. How about you, Natalie? What do you think about Moffat's strengths?
Mine is, what I was going to say was something a little bit more social, especially if we're comparing to Russell T. Davies, because I know a lot of people say that Moffat has been a troll and he's been, whatever, and the way he interacts is, not good. I think he is 100 million times better the way that he treats fans than Russell T. Davies. I love Russell T. Davies as a writer and as a creator of characters. I have ginormous problems with the way that he has talked about fans and the way that he has talked about fan reactions and the way that he's interacted with fans. He doesn't handle it well, and I don't like the way that he acts. I think that Moffat is more of a fan himself. Like, I think that he knows more what that's like, and I never was bothered by his trolling and teasing because I saw it as very playful. I don't think he ever had, and I obviously he got so caught up with people that sometimes he had these interactions that were a bit intense on Twitter and stuff, but I didn't mind it. Like, I thought that it was, obviously it was, too distracting for him or whatever, but I think the way that he talks about fans, I think that he's kind of like, oh, it's gonna mess with your whatever, it's a lot more sort of playful and nice than Russell T. Davies. Like, I am literally laughing at the fact that you care enough about my characters to be upset that I've killed one of them or something like that. Like, it's more of a, I feel like Russell T. Davies was more of like a us against him, whereas Moffat is more in it with us and is just like, I happen to know what's happening. Isn't that funny kind of thing? Like, I have always actually really liked the way that Moffat has interacted with the fandom.
Yeah, like picking up on that too, I feel like Moffat has this incredibly intricate mind that like it's like an encyclopedia that he is just so I feel like he is like the keeper of the knowledge. Like he so remembers every little bit, every little detail that I think he really just his depth of information and what he remembers is really stunning. I think that's it. And that can be a, and I think that can be actually a huge strength and weakness at the same time, because I think sometimes maybe if something makes sense to him, it doesn't, he doesn't realize that it doesn't always make sense to everybody else. You know, because we don't have the same depth of knowledge sometimes. What about weaknesses of Moffat? What kind of, because I know there are definitely, you know, different critiques that have been lobbed by various corners at Moffat over since he's taken over the show of things that he either does well or does not do well. What do you guys think might be one of his bigger weaknesses?
I don't know if he's as good as like with Russell T. Davies, he could string an arc for an entire season. And the clues were clearly there. You just didn't know there were clues at the time. So at the end, with the reveal, you're like, oh my God. And it was always such a big thing. And you could go back and rewatch episodes and figure out what you had missed and kind of put it all together. I don't know if that's a strength for him. Like, I haven't really seen it played out as well as things like Bad Wolf and all the other things that we've seen from Russell T. Davies over time, comparatively to what he's been doing recently. It's kind of not the same thing. So I think that's something that is a bit more challenging for him, is stringing in the little hints and clues along the way to make a really big arc pay off in the end.
He doesn't answer. I think, I mean, it may be that his arcs are just going on even longer, but I feel like, I don't know, I feel like there are unanswered questions still that, for example, from this past season that I don't feel like are ever going to be part of an overarching arc. And so, like, the timeline of, you know, those few episodes of Amy and Rory's, basically the timeline of those five episodes that we saw, you know, how we were trying to work out how that all happened.
Yeah.
I don't think that that was ever answered, and I don't think that it ever will be. And so I think he maybe raises unnecessary questions, but maybe it is. I always thought that his arcs were a little more subtle, like that Russell T. Davies, yeah, you could go back and figure things out, but that Moffat's were sort of more subtle, but that there might be more to them, but I still don't know if there are.
I don't know. Sometimes I feel like when there is the plot hole, too, is that it is a plot hole that could swallow the entire city of London, versus like Davies did have like little things that would pop up and you're like, wait, where did that come from? But like you said here, like when we're sitting there and, you know, little things like when Rory says to his dad, "Dad, I'm 30 years old." Wouldn't the dad have noticed that Rory shouldn't have been 30 years old? You know, things like, you know, how do Amy and Rory, you know, couldn't they just have gotten on a boat and, you know, I don't know,
Yeah, I
gone
mean,
to anywhere and reconnected with the doctor? You know, things like that. You know, but at the same time, the story is line is so compelling, and then we hit the massive big like plot hole like that. Or the other one that I thought was, you know, the biggie too. And I think you know, somebody who we hope to have a podcast at another point, one of the authors, Beth Rivas, has mentioned this, that like, you know, in the last episode, the Statue of Liberty comes a calling. Nobody noticed the gigantic statue plodding off of Liberty Island.
Yeah.
I mean, you heard, you know, I mean, good God, the whole southern end of Manhattan was vibrating. Not a single person in all of Manhattan Island or Jersey looked out
looked
their
at it.
window to
Yeah.
stop the giant statue on either walking forward or backwards. Like, you know, it looked really cool. I mean, did it look really cool that the Statue of Liberty was sitting there baring its teeth over the roof? Sure, but the practicality of that like actually happening just didn't make sense. So I feel like sometimes his plot holes get really huge, and he gets like pissy when somebody points out that that's really huge, and he's just like, "Oh, children have to have problems with this." And I'm like, "Yeah, but that just doesn't mean they should still happen, you know?"
Actually, something that you said just sort of sparked what was just said before as well. In that the thing that you said about like Rory saying like, "Dad, I'm 30," or even the thing about Amy and Rory not visiting, it also ties into what was just said about him being all this knowledge. I think that he has answers for all of these, but I think that maybe he is, and I really hate to say this because I usually love when showrunners do this. I love when they don't play to the lowest common denominator, but I feel like that he might be overestimating the audience, like that he assumes that we know what's, like, not even that, oh, this is a twist, but that he assumes that we have followed the same threads. And I mean, we have. We can work out why Rory's 30 and that, like, that it's meant to be 10 years on, and we can all kind of work that out. And it's not necessarily a plot hole, but they don't specifically say that this is 10 years on for everyone, but we then work out that it is. I think he thinks that everyone is thinking that hard about it, and we are, because we're in a fandom, but it's also the most watched show in the UK by casual viewers or whatever, so it may be that he assumes that everyone's as intensely picking up on everything as he is, or that he knows that some hardcore fans are, and that that might not actually be the case, and that he might actually need to explain things a little bit to the lowest common denominator of watchers, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and actually when it comes to Who, like, I think that lowest, I think it's, like, it's a higher common denominator, but I think it's not quite as high as Moffat's banking on some of the time.
It's not the lowest common denominator of Glee, you know, it's not that. But it's a higher level than that, but it's still not everyone's a crazy fandom analysis person. And he is, and he seems to think that everyone is. And that's kind of awesome. But the fact of the matter is, it's not really a cult show. It's a very, 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 very big show, especially in the UK. So
Right. No, absolutely. You know, and I think also sometimes too is that he doesn't. I mean, he is personable. He is a very personable human being, as you mentioned, Natalie. But I feel sometimes in a Q&A situation on a live stage, he's just a little too aloof and is a little too, oh, I can't tell you that, because if I did tell you that, you'd know everything. Like, I don't think he's not as good at teasing us with a kernel of information as he could be. I think other showrunners are much better at that in varying other series. I think even J.K. Rowling, I'll just use her as a source that so many people are familiar with. As she was writing the Potter books, I mean, obviously she kept everything very close to the chest, but she would give little hints and tidbits. Like, when you would get an interview with J.K. Rowling, you would get some really fantastic information out of there. And it didn't per se spoil anything. It led to wonderful speculation. But the problem is, I feel a lot of times with Moffat, you'll get, oh, yes, we're going to wonderful places and you're going to enjoy it. And, oh, it's going to be grand. And I just can't tell you anything more than that. And I'm like, and fantastic. Cool. We have 10 adjectives that mean positive, and I have nowhere to go with this. You know, I feel like he could give us more of a kernel of something and not give away the whole store, but give us something to talk about. We didn't have too much in our mailbag, but I did want to bring up one thing from one of our listeners because I thought it was fun. A lot of our mailbag was people basically agreeing with different things that we had come up with in regards to the Christmas episode, and a lot of people really liking the Christmas episode and not being able to wait for the next series. But I did want to give a shout out to one of our viewers because I read this and I literally doubled over laughing when the name came up, because I've been literally every time you start talking about Clara, or when you write an article, it's like Clara or Oswin or whoever she is this time. Because honestly, what the heck is her name? And I've got to give props to Gary65, who came up with the name, and he started calling her Clawswin. I died laughing. I was like, Gary, props to you, because I'm now calling her Clawswin, because it is the best name ever, because we don't know what to refer to her, you know, other than going, the new companion. You know how boring it is to keep writing the new companion? So I just wanted to give some props to Gary for the Clawswin thing, because I could not stop laughing when I read that, and I'm totally using that from now on.
Do you think her modern incarnation is going to be called Clawswin? I mean, Clara?
Yeah, I would guess it would be Clara. We don't know that for sure. I suppose so.
Could be a totally new name that we haven't even heard yet.
Right.
Right. Going to get confusing.
Yeah,
because
that wouldn't be too complicated. Let's give her a new name with every
reincarnation. Every episode. Like, yeah. This is going to be weird.
Right, exactly. So I like Clausewind. Although now here's the one that's getting speculated about on and off, and I think it's a legit thing. You know, everybody keeps asking Matt Smith, you know, is Matt Smith going to continue past this series? And I think obviously it remains to be seen. But the question is Clara Oswin or Clausewind, going to call her Clausewind, is Clausewind going to be back? Because some of our very astute listeners and viewers noticed that in the Christmas episode, when Clara is observing the tombstone of the other Clara, the date on it is November the 23rd, which would be the 50th anniversary date. So is that just mere homage, or is that, you know, somehow significant? What do you guys think? Do you think she's going to be a one-off companion, and then come 2014, there'll be a brand new companion, or do you think she's going to be around for a while?
I would think that they would try to base it a little bit more on how her interactions with the Doctor go and how her character develops and what the fan... Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like Amy and Rory stayed for so long because they had great chemistry with Matt Smith, they had a lot of story to tell, and they were really people who were liked by the fans. And I know that's not the only reason people write scripts and that they're, you know... A lot of times people have an end game in mind, but I think that in this case it does play into it a bit. If someone doesn't really love a companion, like if a companion bombs and you're losing your core audience, you don't want to keep them there. And you know, on the flip side, if a companion is doing fantastic, do you really only want to keep them a very short period of time?
Yeah.
You know, have they served their purpose? So I guess it depends on how Moffat kind of pictured her. And I did watch the interview they did, like, pre-Christmas, where Moffat was saying, you know, we had this idea of who Clara was going to be, and then we got Jenna Louise in, and we auditioned her, and then, you know, she's become someone completely different because of who Jenna is, not because of what direction they were taking her in, but they let Jenna kind of play with it and make Clara who she is, and that's kind of changed how they've written Clara. So does how Jenna acts and how Jenna is received, does that change what her storyline could be, or is there always that end game? So, I mean, I guess we have to look at it from that perspective on how they play the storyline and what they think. It, you know, is it dependent on a fan reaction and how everyone's feeling about it, or is her storyline very specific?
And you're right. I heard Moffat talking about, you know, we change things up, and that's a good point. I mean, I think it would be cool because in the modern era, the last time we had a companion bridge doctors was Rose Tyler back in 2005, 2006. But it's certainly something that happened in Classic Who all the time. You know, Sarah Jane bridge doctors, all sorts of people bridge doctors. It's not an uncommon feat. So I think it actually might be kind of cool. I mean, and this is, again, presupposing that Matt Smith is going anywhere. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't, but, you know.
Yeah, I don't want to contribute to this because I don't want to lose Matt. Like, I know that people say this about the end of every Doctor, but I think, you know, I know Tennant was meant to be a hard act to follow, but I think Matt is going to be a harder one.
I think part of the genius of casting Matt Smith in casting the youngest Doctor ever was that they nailed the young audience. They just grabbed him, you know. I mean, and prior to that, Tennant was the youngest Doctor. Well, no, I guess maybe Peter Davison and him were just about the same age. But, I mean, you know, we had never cast a Doctor who wasn't, you know, in his mid-30s before, you know, and most of them were well over 40, if not in their 50s. So I think part of the genius was casting somebody who was younger, but can play old soul. I think that was a huge
I think he acts a lot older than 10. I mean, I think 10 acted the most human and kind of, yeah, just like, he kind of acted just like an irrational 35-year-old man some of the time. Whereas Matt is either very, you know, childish or very old. But yeah, I'm not quite ready for him to go. I'm not sure. I mean, that would be fine if Clara stayed for the new companion, but at the moment I don't want to think about that because I don't want Matt to go.
Well, guys, thank you all for listening to us in this episode of Who Hype. News is sparse right now because what's going on is they are finishing up the post-production of the second half of the series. They're completely done filming. It's all taking place inside the Roath Lock Center. which means they're doing all their CGI, and Moffat has said the second half of the season is very heavy on the CGI. So they're all working very hard at the technical end, which unfortunately means none of us get to see anything, you know, as they film out in the open. But we're all just going to be counting down until they come back, and I know I, for one, just can't wait. So until we record again, I'm Laura.
I'm Jen.
I'm Natalie.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye.